This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello there, and welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
If you are a progressive or a leftist, you have to be very excited about what is happening in America these days. First, you had the coronavirus lockdowns that caused people to stop flying and driving, cut down the greenhouse gas emissions. Then the government went on full socialist printing up trillions of dollars mode, giving people free money. Then you had the George Floyd killing, and you had protests filling the streets, politicians apologizing for white privilege, blue chip companies donating millions of dollars to Black Lives Matter. It was all fantastic. Now, this week, the Supreme Court delivered a landmark victory to the LGBTQ movement that will reshape life in America. If you want to see America transformed into a social justice paradise, you have to be thrilled about what is happening now. To learn about this Supreme Court ruling, we will turn to Andrew.
Yeah, it's been a blockbuster week for the Supreme Court. On Monday, they ruled on Bostock versus Clayton County. And the gist of this ruling is they ruled that the 1964 Civil Rights Act now includes sexual orientation and gender identity. And what I mean there is in 1964, Congress passed a Civil Rights Act basically saying to the government and even public companies can't discriminate against you because of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Now they've added that these companies, they can't hire you or fire you, mainly fire you, because of your race, color, religion, national origin, sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. Two new ones on there. Mm. And the most, at least surprising thing is how they came to this ruling is it was a 6-3 ruling with the four typical progressive judges ruling for this, plus Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Neil Gorsuch, which was surprising. Is Neil Gorsuch, he was supposed to be, or at least he was reported to be, like the new Antonin Scalia. He was going to be this conservative, originalist, textualist, constitutionalist judge that was very against legislating from the bench, making new laws from the bench. The point of the American government is Congress makes laws, the president enforces those laws, and the Supreme Court arbitrates disputes if there's a dispute over the constitutionality, but they're not supposed to add to the law things that weren't originally in there. And in this case, now Gorsuch, now he's still claiming this is a textualist decision. His he wrote the majority opinion for this. And he said, an employer who fires an individual for being homosexual or transgender fires that person for traits or actions which would not have been questioned in members of a different sex. Mm-hmm. So he's basically saying that this word sex in the 1964 Civil Rights Act includes your biological sex, the sex you identify as, and the sex you're attracted to just lump homosexuals and transgenders into this law that says a company can't, you could work for a church supposedly, I guess, and they can't fire you for engaging in homosexual activity, even if it's against the principles of that company. Because it's now federally illegal. It violates the 1964 Civil Rights Act because of this ruling. Mm-hmm. And now the dissent in this, now the three dissenting judges were Brett Kavanaugh, Clarence Thomas, and Alito. And Justice Samuel Alito wrote the dissenting opinion, where he was calling, I think he used the word preposterous and refers to Gorsuch's language here, because he says we're supposed to be interpreting the laws as written. And he said no one in Congress in 1964 who passed this law would have agreed that when they wrote sex, they meant
right
homosexuals and transgenders.
Right.
And yeah, you can't fire someone for being a woman, not for being a homosexual.
Yeah, it's like this silly kind of schoolyard semantic game for them to say that, well, if you have a man on your staff and a woman on your staff, and they both want to dress like a woman, and they both want to... they're both attracted to men and so on, that for you to say that the man can't dress like a woman just because he's a man, that this is sex, you know, that's what they meant, essentially. I think Alito expressed it really well. He said something like, this is a pirate ship flying a textualist flag. You know, that it's using the idea that, well, we're just going to stick with the original language. But the idea that in 1964, I mean, no one was thinking anything like this. And to argue that this is essentially what the law means is remarkably torturous intellectual thinking.
Right. And dangerous in the precedent as well, because I think the Federalist had a piece on this that made the point that said basically the Supreme Court's decision here is based on the assertion that a man is a woman, mm-hmm. or basically they called a man a woman. They said, and now that is legal precedent. And so in future
right.
cases on things like this, you can cite like, oh, well, in this case, they talked about this. Like, you can't discriminate on sex because sex refers to... gender identity. You could use that in future rulings to say that basically any time, any law on the books that uses the word sex, it's like you either have to admit you were wrong on this ruling or just start interpreting
yeah.
all the rulings that way. Every America's got books and books and shelves of legal code going right. all the way back to 1789.
Right. And this is exactly what the LGBTQ movement was looking for, is something that would demonstrate that there is no difference if someone thinks he's a man or a woman and actually biological reality. And so they are just itching to have legal challenges like crazy. I mean, I think this is fantastic evidence, thinking about what Neil Gorsuch and John Roberts in particular did here, of just how these supposed conservatives do not understand the nature of these forces that are trying to destroy America. This is going to create just tens of thousands of lawsuits. I mean, you could imagine the kinds of legal problems that this is going to generate for years and years to come, that will, ruling by ruling, transform America into a different place. And they don't understand how important it is to prevent that with a decision like this.
Right, yeah, and it's been a downhill slope even since that Obergefell versus Hodges that legalized mm-hmm. homosexual marriage, and that was Justice Anthony Kennedy who sided with the liberals on that one, and then there were quite a few people who were surprised he did that, because he was nominally a conservative, supposed to be a conservative justice. Now you've got people like Neil Gorsuch who are supposedly tenfold as conservative as Anthony Kennedy was, even going over feeding into that same precedent. So between this just kind of like precedent after precedent, you're erasing basically all legal distinctions between mm-hmm. men and women. Not just saying men and women should have equal legal rights, but saying that they don't exist.
Right. And the other point I think is a good one, is the fact that there were legislatures across the country that were moving in this direction. And that if they want the law changed, that is the way to change the law. It's with the lawmaking bodies. And essentially, this is the Supreme Court stepping into the rule of legislation and deciding this is what the law is going to be through what is essentially, even at the hand of a Gorsuch, judicial activism.
Right. There's definitely two very dangerous trends here. I mean, one of them is probably more obvious, jumps out at you, is the to anyone who believes in biblical morality, just the moral collapse of, I mean, you can go through all Ephesians 5 and enumerative other scriptures that talk about the importance of gender roles that there's a societal campaign to erase here. But then there's also the legal threat to America, to where we're supposed to be a constitutional republic where, like I said before, Congress makes laws, the president enforces them, and if a question over the constitutionality of a law comes up, the Supreme Court arbitrates. But when you can just change the meaning of a word to from a law that was passed decades ago to mean something that it didn't used to mean, you're starting to get into a point where Congress is almost irrelevant as the supreme lawmaking authority. You can either via executive action from the president or judicial activism from the Supreme Court.
You mentioned that this was a big week for the Supreme Court, or a doozy of a week. I forget the word that you used, but the other ruling came down yesterday was the Supreme Court ruled against Donald Trump that he had the authority to strike down DACA, which they admitted President Obama did not have the authority to make. So President Obama passed this act that was pro-immigration and open borders, essentially by executive fiat. And the court said, yeah, he didn't really have the authority to do that, and yet Donald Trump doesn't have the authority to strike it down by executive fiat. Again, the court is just showing remarkable failure in you know, judgment in these cases.
Right. No, that one is just crazy. I didn't look at the details of that, the ruling, of to what rationale they were looking at when they made that. But like you said, you summed it up well, that like this DACA, it's President Obama via executive order said that he wasn't going to deport the children of illegal immigrants. No congressional authority to do that. He just said he wouldn't do it by executive order. And then Trump says, like, well, I'll make an executive order to overturn his executive order. And they're like, well, you can't do that. So it's like, no, it's like you can't just have a previous president say something with no backing from Congress and have it carry the force of law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, if you want more information about the ramifications of this judgment, this pro-LGBT judgment that came down earlier this week, we really recommend that you request a copy of our booklet, Redefining Family. It describes this trend that has been going on for years, and this latest ruling from the Supreme Court will advance that movement considerably and very aggressively. It's been very aggressive, but this really does threaten to move it along even faster. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. Moving on now, George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, Minnesota, but somehow that hasn't stopped protesters in Britain from getting in on the act. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I think we've seen an important week of capitulation, really, to the whole Black Lives Matter movement in Britain. And you might remember a few years ago, there was the whole Roads Must Fall movement, I think back in 2015, and there was, you know, all of these pressure groups. They wanted a statue of Cecil Rhodes at Oxford University. I think it's at Oriel College there. They wanted that statue removed, and there were big protests and things like that, and it seemed like it was building momentum. And Oxford University said no. They held firm. We're not going to take that statue down. He donated a whole lot of money to the college. We still use this money that he donated and left in his will to be used by people, regardless of race, to come to Oxford. We still use that money for that purpose. We're going to keep that statue there. And they held firm and they won. And the protesters went away and Rhodes stayed. This week, Oxford announced Rhodes would fall. And now this Black Lives Matter movement is gaining victories that they had to retreat from 5 years ago. And I think that shows this this renewed success that they're having and this renewed spirit of capitulation that exists here in Britain. And that was just one event from this last week. I can't remember whether we talked about it on the show last week, but of course you had Winston Churchill and George Washington statues in London being boarded up in anticipation of coming protests. You know, rather than trying to protect those statues, authorities in London decided it was easier just to hide them, just to surrender, basically, and cover these statues up. You've had British companies agree to pay reparations. Now, maybe I have a little more sympathy for this one, but you've had back in 1833, when Britain outlawed slavery, they compensated the owners of slaves, and some of the successor companies to the companies and businessmen that got compensated back in 1833 have said, well, we're going to pay the compensation back, and we'll use that money in some of these other charities. But they're giving it generally to these far left, extreme Black Lives Matter causes. You had the Bank of England and the Church of England come out and apologizing for their roles in slavery. You've had the Premier League football restarting with all the players taking a knee to Black Lives Matter and playing with, instead of their name on the back of their T-shirts, with Black Lives Matter written on the back of their T-shirts. So everywhere you look, you see people giving in to this movement. You've had radio hosts fired for questioning the idea of white privilege. And it's even Nigel Farage lost his job as a major broadcaster at LBC Radios, one of their biggest broadcasters. He's out. He's fired because he compared Black Lives Matter to the Taliban, which seems to be that's a pretty objectively true comparison. Both believe in tearing down statues that offend their sensibilities. So, everywhere you look, surrendering to the mob here in the UK.
Stephen Fleury's been talking about this quite a lot on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and drawing attention to the fact that even though slavery and these kinds of racial tensions have been a part of many, many nations over history, that it's only Britain and America that are so self-flagellating and so apologetic about that history. You gave an outstanding Trumpet Daily Show on Wednesday, just going back through the history of slavery. Maybe you could just summarize what you spoke about there and put what we're talking about here in that context.
Yeah, that context is important. I'd be happy to. So you look at all of the world's history, and just about every people, every civilization has had slavery. Right back to the kind of the dawn of the earlier cities. And you look even at the slave trade, and this was the transatlantic slave trade was a crime that a lot of countries were guilty of. Portugal transporting more slaves than any other country. And then when the Europeans were transporting these slaves, they were buying them from African kings and African rulers. And it was Brazil was one of the biggest targets or destinations for slaves. It involved a whole lot of people, but you only see Britain and America under attack. But what's really unique about Britain and America is the way that these two voluntarily abolished slavery. I can't think of any other countries in the world that abolished an institution like this while it was still profitable and while they were not really under any special pressure to do so. They just decided it was morally wrong and that they were going to shut it down. And both countries made huge sacrifices to do that. And you obviously, I think most people know about the American Civil War, where there were other factors than slavery involved, but right at its heart was slavery and this idea that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And it was people willing to lay down their lives for that principle. And it ended in 4 million slaves being freed. What isn't as widely known is the role that the British Empire played in freeing slaves all around the world. Britain outlawed the slave trade and Britain and America both March 1807 outlawed the slave trade, America at least transatlantic slave trade. And then Britain after that went out of its way to shut down slavery wherever it could. You know, just you're creating the West Africa Squadron, whose whole purpose was to patrol the coast and the Atlantic and arrest, capture slave ships, arrest the owners, set the slaves free. And as time went on, Britain was taking more and more dramatic action to go into Africa and to land on the shores and to free the slaves, to go into Brazil's inland waterways to make sure that they were complying with their treaties not to trade in slaves. And it was these two powers that shut this down all around this world, this practice that had been legal and going on for millennia. So, well, then that raises the question, well, why are these the ones under attack? Mm-hmm. You know, why? What is Black Lives Matter and Roads Must Fall and all of this really about? And it's the fact that these two countries have a history with God. That you know, we've talked in this program before about seeing the Bible in history, and we've had some great articles recently from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry in that, seeing God's role in history. Mm-hmm. And you see that in the way that he raised up these two powers. And you know, he didn't do that just for Britain and America's benefit. He did that to teach lessons to the whole world. And Joshua 4 and verse 24, I think it is, talks about how God performs these miracles for Israel, but he does it with the entire world in mind. Mm-hmm. There's a fantastic purpose behind that. And so when Black Lives Matter try and attack this history and say, well, it's all just slavery, you know, all of Britain and America's prosperity, that just comes from slavery. It's not a miracle from God. And then these powers are just evil. What's really under attack isn't just Britain and America. It's an attack on God. And it's this attempt to – it's all just part of this attempt to wipe out the name of Israel. But it's about an attack on a signpost that points the world to how to solve its problems, how to really have national prosperity, turn to God in obedience. So that's why this movement is just so insidious, so dangerous. And you can just see lies running all through it.
Yeah, the fact that it is America and Britain that are being targeted, it points you to Brad McDonald made this point in his cover story in the July edition of The Trumpet about how there is this intent to blot out the name of Israel, Israel being the progenitor for Ephraim and Manasseh, that name being put on those descendants of Israel and those being the progenitors of Britain and America. Gerald Flurry's been talking about that with just in light of that prophecy in 2 Kings about God actually using Jeroboam to save Israel from this this threat to blot out its name. And it's like with so many things with prophecy, the more you understand the prophecy, the clearer it is why what you're looking at is unfolding the way that it is. This is just a fantastic example. Thanks for that, Richard. If you want more information about this, really dig into the newest Trumpet edition. We just posted it up on the website this week with really blockbuster articles, especially from Gerald Flurry and from Stephen Flurry on this subject. Stephen Flurry's article, Surrendering to Lawlessness, is talking about exactly this kind of capitulation to the mob that you're seeing with the Rhodes statue and what's happening in the United Kingdom. An outstanding issue that I think you'll really get a lot of benefit from if you dig into it. So we do appreciate that, Richard. Moving on now, China and India are both nuclear powers, but a violent clash this week between soldiers from the two countries looked like something out of the Middle Ages. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, this was at a place in the Ladakh region near the Galwan River. It's a place that both China and India claim as their own land, far up in the Himalayan mountains there. And they actually fought a bloody war there back in 1962 that left over 1,000 on both sides dead. And ever since then, there have been some flare-ups and there have been tensions. But the clashes that happened this week were the bloodiest that they've had since the 1960s. So this happened at a place that Chinese troops recently seized control of. In the last few months, China has gradually taken about 23 square miles of what was previously territory controlled by India. And then last week, things seem to be de-escalating after China agreed to vacate one of these areas that they occupied. So on Monday, India had about 120 soldiers or so there to oversee the, you know, the Chinese vacating that area. But then all of a sudden, the Chinese started attacking the Indians. And they didn't use advanced weaponry because there are protocols in place that they both signed back in the 60s that banned firing guns in this area. So the Chinese soldiers instead attacked the Indians with stones and clubs and rods spiked with nails or wrapped in barbed wire. There are photographs available of some of these clubs that they use, these nail-studded weapons, and it's just nauseating to envision that slamming into a person. But that's what the Chinese did. They ended up having just a gruesome battle of hand-to-hand combat that lasted between 6 and 7 hours. And though these weapons were very primitive, it killed at least 23 Indian soldiers and maybe as many as 43 Chinese soldiers. So just a really heartrending outbreak of violence there high up in the Himalayas.
And talk about China's strategy in doing this and how this kind of fits into the larger picture of what China has been up to.
Well, a lot of this specifically with China, I think they just want to distract India from being able to develop their navy. So they try to keep them occupied in what's essentially an inhospitable little slice of land way up and, you know, 14,000 feet above sea level, a place that is just frozen. And you would think it would be geopolitically irrelevant, but I think it's mainly a just a distraction, trying to keep India occupied. And also the PLA wants to keep their troops busy and get them some training as often as they can. But analysts have noticed the way that the way China has taken over this territory in the last few months, just kind of occupying a little bit very quietly, then pushing in a little bit deeper, and then just quietly taking a little bit more. Many are saying that this is another example of what's called salami slicing. This tactic of expansion that's just very gradual. And it's the same tactic that we see China using in the South China Sea. Over the last 6 years or so, slowly, gradually, they build these islands. Then they insist that they're strictly for civilian use. But then they slowly militarize them. It's an approach that China uses to expand its territory because it works. You know, if you just flew into the South China Sea and immediately and loudly took over, or perhaps in the Himalayas, then other nations would take issue and they would take actions to reverse it. But if you do it gradually enough, tell enough lies, you know, especially if it's during the presidency of someone like President Obama, which is when China did its salami slicing in the South China Sea, then you can probably get away with it. And up here in the Himalayas, it does look like that same basic tactic. Tanvi Madan is the director of the India Project at the Brookings Institution, and she spoke about what's been happening there in the Himalayas with China, and she said, what they seem to be trying to do is the territorial version of what they've done in the South China Sea. So it is, you know, it is a calculated and a gradual strategy. We also see a lot of that sort of thing from Russia in places like Ukraine and Georgia, just taking here a little, there a little, because these revisionist powers know that that kind of shadowy and surreptitious hybrid warfare is not very likely to elicit a big response.
Well, let's talk about prophecy, because the overarching prophecy that we're looking to unfold in Asia is the coming together of all of these nations. This certainly demonstrates, and we see, and we'll even talk in the second half, evidence of China's rise and ascendancy in power within the region, which is what we do expect based on those prophecies. But the relationship between China and India being so fraught is actually something that is a bit counter to what you would expect looking at the prophecy. We have to put that in the larger context. Maybe you can just help us do that.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Tensions do remain high right now between China and India. And in the near term, who knows? I think it's possible that these tensions could escalate into more border clashes. But because of the prophecies, the Trumpet believes that a major conflict between China and India will not happen. And if isolated clashes do continue, they'll be short-lived. And that's just because there are very clear prophecies in the book of Revelation that talk about one of the main powers in the fast-approaching Third World War being a group called the Kings of the East. And this is an Asian power. There's another passage there in Ezekiel 38 that gives some just extraordinary detail about which specific countries will be a part of these Kings of the East. And so it gives names signifying modern Russia, modern China, modern Japan, and a few others, and also India. You know, these are names that you have to understand where these people migrated to. They're ancient names, but Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has proven in his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, you know, exactly who these various nations are. So it's pretty easy to understand it if you read that. And India has long been a very close friend of Russia. And even though its relations with China right now are under considerable strain from these prophecies, we know that those tensions won't last. And really, it could be Russia, who's very close with both China and India, who could kind of moderate the current dispute and bring an end to it. But however it happens, we know that China and India will soon be fighting with far more than sticks and stones, but it won't be against each other. It will be as allies.
Well, Jeremiah has an article about this latest clash, China and India, two nuclear powers clash with sticks and stones. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. We'll also link in the show notes to today's program to Gerald Fleury's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, that explains Russia's role in that future alliance. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. Well, on Wednesday's program, we spoke about the stringent new sanctions the Trump administration is leveling against Syria. These could have real implications for Lebanon as well. To learn about this, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, if you didn't catch the program on Wednesday, we were talking about the CESAR Act that came into play this Wednesday. And it really is a serious level of sanctions that have been brought upon the Syrian regime and anyone else that does business with the Syrian regime. And this is important considering that there's a lot of countries with their companies that were hoping to get into Syria and start reconstructing the country. But now if they do that, the U.S. Treasury is going to be sanctioning those individuals, be them Russia, Iranian, or Lebanese. And so basically this act has ensured that America will not back any reconstruction of Syria until Assad is gone. And so we talked about that on Wednesday's program. And for today, I just want to think a little bit more about the effect that this is going to have on Lebanon, because Lebanon is right next to Syria towards its west on the Mediterranean coast, and is often used as a transit point for goods that keeps the Assad regime afloat. Of course, operating out of Syria, and one of the main players in Syria now is Hezbollah, which is an Iranian ally. And so that makes sense that you're going to have Hezbollah in Lebanon, Syria, and Iran working together. And what this law or what this act is designed to do, which is a law also, is to try and cut off Lebanon from being able to feed the Syrian regime as well. Right now, there's a lot of subsidized products that are bought by the Lebanese, that are subsidized by the Lebanese government, that are intended for Lebanese citizens. And Lebanon right now is perhaps going to be up to about 65% below the poverty line come the end of this year, facing an unparalleled financial crisis, riots on the streets, the worst the situation has been there since the Lebanese civil war. That's today. That's without this act. Mm-hmm. And what this act is going to try and expose is that a lot of these goods, such as wheat and diesel, have been pouring across the border into Syria to try and keep the Syrian regime alive, which is often called, Lebanon is often called one of the lungs of Syria, so that it can breathe. The United States is chopping off that lung and is saying, anyone in Lebanon, if you do business with Syria, now you're going to be sanctioned. And most of these organizations and companies that are smuggling these goods that Lebanon needs across over into Syria are Hezbollah. And so this has been, a really smart decision by the U.S. administration to find a way to target Hezbollah without hurting the rest of Lebanon. And because Hezbollah is the main one doing this smuggling to help their friend and ally Assad, it looks to be able to be hitting them hard back in Lebanon.
What does prophecy reveal about Lebanon's future, and how does this tie in with what you're seeing here?
Right. So as we kind of detailed on Wednesday, there is a prophecy in Psalm 83 that indicates that both Lebanon and Syria are not going to be in cahoots with the Iranians. And so we have expected a split there to take place. And as I mentioned on Wednesday as well, I think this Caesar Act really does show that America is serious at trying to cut off Syria and Lebanon from Iran's hold, and it might actually do that because there is no going forward for the regime with this act in place if it wants to survive. And while we've been talking about Syria for a long time, right now it is back at square one for the Syrian regime back at home. Poverty in a way that it's never seen, lost the currency, it's lost half its value in the past month. You have riots from people like the Druze in the south that have never rioted against Assad's rule. For the first time in 9 years, they're coming out and saying, Assad, you've got to go. And so while it's been going on for a long time, we are seeing a change here in Syria. And if it changes in Syria, there is also going to be a big change in Lebanon, and that's what we expect to take place. Our editor-in-chief has written about this. He wrote an article, Why You Should Watch Lebanon, and that's based on that prophecy in Psalm 83. And it goes into details at how Hezbollah and Iran's power is going to lose hold on that nation.
We have seen a certain amount of that division within Lebanon as well, where you have the citizenship kind of turning against Hezbollah there. Am I wrong to assume that this act would exacerbate that division?
Right. It's going to exacerbate that for sure, because it's going to show the Lebanese that are on the streets today fighting for bread, mm-hmm. fighting to try and get dollars as American dollars as their currency goes into free fall, where they lose their life savings. And it's going to expose Hezbollah as helping out Syria instead of looking after the Lebanese. And so it is only going to exacerbate tensions. It's hard to see how that won't result in it doesn't look like it's going to result in a peaceful transition of power out of Hezbollah's hand there, just because the people are already at facing horrific horrific struggle. But yeah, this will probably inflame those tensions even more.
Why You Should Watch Lebanon, the article from our editor-in-chief. We'll link to that in our show notes. And thank you very much for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll talk about what it means that General James Mattis has turned against President Donald Trump. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
President Donald Trump has a lot of enemies, and it seems like the list is growing all the time. That includes military leaders and one prominent former member of his own cabinet. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there have been probably, by my latest count, 89 former defense officials who have, in recent weeks, accused President Trump of betraying his oath of office. Many of them even signed an open letter saying as much. I don't actually know that General James Mattis was on the open letter, but he's probably the most prominent former general in the news right now, coming out against President Trump. He wrote a statement that was obtained by CNN where he says, Donald Trump is the first president in my lifetime who does not try to unite the American people. He tries to divide us. We are witnessing the consequences of 3 years of this deliberate effort. And now these comments, they're in the context of right during the, at the beginning of these race riots over George Floyd's death. President Trump got out on the Rose Garden by the White House, and he announced that, this is what Mr. Trump said, we're ending the riots and lawlessness that has spread throughout our country. It'll end now. I have strongly recommended to every governor to deploy the National Guard in sufficient numbers that we dominate the streets. Mayors and governors must establish an overwhelming law enforcement presence until the violence has been quelled. If a city or state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend life and property of their residents, I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them. And so it's mainly that last statement about President Trump saying that, well, if they don't get these riots under control, I'll deploy the military, that has Marine Corps General James Mattis and the rest of them upset at President Trump. And now, granted, that is a serious step to deploy the military. Now, they're prematurely accusing him of violating the Constitution and betraying his oath of office for even saying that, because there are constitutional means by which you can deploy the military to solve problems like this. President Trump, he mentioned the Insurrection Act of 1807, which says that if a state legislature or a state governor requests the help, the president can send in federal troops to quell an insurrection. And that act was even amended after the U.S. Civil War to say that if the insurrection's so bad that it looks like the state government itself is in threat of being overthrown, he can just deploy the troops without getting the state's approval. And so far, no governors have asked him to deploy troops. And so, and the rioting's not so bad that it's looking at overthrowing a state legislature. So it is not bad enough for him to take that step, but it could get that bad. And these generals coming out and telling the public that he's betraying his oath of office for mentioning the possibility that it could get that bad definitely aren't helping the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's a lot of prominent generals, even former defense secretaries, speaking against the president for mentioning this Insurrection Act. And then this is a big deal because, like I mentioned, right now the riots probably aren't bad enough to warrant needing Marines in the streets. The police and the National Guard should be able to handle it. But if
they're taking a knee in all of these situations.
Right. I think that's mainly why I brought up the Marines, is like the police should be able to handle this. If they're going to give up, then I guess we can use the National Guard. And if the National Guard's going to give up, then I guess we can use the Marines. But then you start getting troops in the street and people get antsy and you get more national division because of that. And that really gets to the heart of this threat is that, I mean, I've seen a security analyst right before that they said, well, they said some people say that another civil war is imminent, but that could never really happen because even if Black Lives Matter gets some pretty bad riots, if you ever did send the military into the streets, it's pretty much game over. They could handle it. And so a lot of people take comfort in that, like, well, if race riots get too bad or if civil war type tension gets too bad, the military can protect us. But now you're seeing the president bring up that exact same possibility of using the military to protect people. And you're getting numerous former generals and defense secretaries speaking against him, which raises the very disturbing possibility of what if these communist agitators stirring up race riots stirred up enough violence that the president did have to deploy the military? And what if the division within the military is bad enough that some of the soldiers decide to not follow that order or even take up arms against the president, the Trump administration himself? Now you've got like Civil War style crisis with factions of the military fighting for opposing sides. And in some ways, you'd almost have to expect something like that to happen because there's a lot of prophecies we talk about on this program. Isaiah 1 verse 7 talks about your city is being burned with fire. Ezekiel 5 and verse 12 is talking about even like a third part of you being devoured in pestilence and in rioting and in urban warfare. And now in America, that's some pretty sobering math. A third part's like more than 100 million people.
Mm-hmm.
That's which would seem
impossible
like for that.
Unless
that would take it's you're not going to kill 100 million people by flash mobs looting Walgreens. if they did anywhere get anywhere that bad, you'd think the military would stop it, unless the military itself is divided. Now, I have an article online right now titled "Retired Generals Clash with President Trump" that looks into some of the polling statistics to try to do the best they can to quantify political division in the military. And it's talking about, like, in the Marine Corps, they say about 65% of the troops support President Trump or approve of his job performance. But in the Navy, that's down to 50%. And then the Army and the Air Force, that's down to, like, 36, 37%. So there's significant portions of the military that don't like what President Trump's, how he's running the country. Mm-hmm. And so if he did have to use troops to stop a race riot or a Civil War level crisis, yeah, it's definitely, even scripture aside, within the, you can see the evidence that you're looking at an 1861 Civil War style division in the nation.
Well, Andrew has an article up on the website, Retired Generals Clash with President Trump. We'll link to that in the show notes. It gives it's quite a detailed article. Go check that out. We'll also link to an article from several years back called How to Lose a War. Right now, the military still has quite a reputation among the American people, which is why when someone like General Mattis criticizes the president, it really stings. But the reality is the military has been changing for quite some time, moving in the direction of political correctness and such, and you can read about that in that article. Thank you very much, Andrew. It's really for developments like those we were just discussing and many others that America's standing in the world is waning. In Asia, countries see this, and they're increasingly looking to China for leadership instead. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, researchers at the Center for Strategic and International Studies have just published the findings of a new survey that they conducted, and it shows that there's a growing perception among Southeast Asians that China is now the main power in their countries and just in the general region there, and also that the U.S. is losing influence. So the countries surveyed were Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, the Philippines, Fiji, and the world's fourth most populous country, Indonesia. And CSIS surveyed a couple of dozen individuals from each of these countries who are considered to be non-governmental strategic elites. So these are, you know, titans of industry and business moguls and just movers and shakers of all kinds. And the findings were really telling. The main conclusion of the report is about political power. It says, quote, China is seen as holding slightly more political power and influence than the U.S. in Southeast Asia today, and considerably more power relative to the U.S. in 10 years. So these individuals believe China has already passed the U.S. up in terms of political power, and that the gap will get much wider as the years go by. And then the same question was asked about economic power. And on that one, instead of saying China has slightly more influence, the consensus was that China has much more influence. And again, the Southeast Asians think the gap will greatly widen in the years ahead to China's continued advantage. So this just shows that, you know, despite the much vaunted pivot to Asia that the U.S. has supposedly been doing ever since the Obama years, America's influence in the region is quickly fading and China's is growing.
Well, if you want more information about this, you can go check out our article, Will America's Asian Allies Pivot to China? We will link to that in the show notes, as well as our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. Thank you, Jeremiah. How anti-Israel was the Obama administration? It was pushing for destructive resolutions in the UN against Israel to the point that Benjamin Netanyahu actually had to get help from Russia. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
So this is a story that has been quietly reported on, I guess, for about 6 months here and there, but not confirmed. But it has been confirmed now that the United States wanted to push through a second resolution at the UN in the final days of President Obama's tenure. This is during the transition period as Donald Trump had been elected This vote was due to take place after the one that did take place, if I can call it that. The one that everyone's familiar with is when the United States refused to use its veto on a resolution of Security Council that called all the settlements illegal, called any habitation of Israelis past the 67 lines as illegal, called the old city, Israelis living there or Jews living in the old city, as illegal. And we report on the time that that was absolutely horrible, and it showed how much Obama hated the state of Israel, as this was a parting shot from his administration against Netanyahu and the people of Israel. Well, it turns out that he had actually planned a second one. This was going to be a resolution that was going to declare the parameters for a future Palestinian state, declare Palestinian state, and then also set up a time frame for when the talks that were leading to the state had to be completed. And so this was something that was bantered about at the UN. Israel's UN ambassador, Danny Dannon, caught wind of this, told Netanyahu about it, that there was another resolution that was coming. Netanyahu called up Vladimir Putin, said, "We can't let this happen. This is absolutely crazy." And that's where the story kind of died about 6 months ago, of one or two reports about it. But it turns out that the United States was actually not necessarily involved in stopping this resolution, meaning the United States being the transition team under General Flynn, who was the incoming national security advisor of Donald Trump. But the Russians told Flynn in a call on December 29th that Russia has decided to not go ahead and back this new American resolution against the state of Israel. And this came out on the release of those transcripts, that everyone was focused on Russia and the calls about Ukraine and all of this, when the whole reason for those calls between Kislyak and Flynn were about what the Obama administration was doing at the UN, and Flynn trying to get Russia to see what they were going to do about it. And then the second call was Kislyak saying to Flynn, "I know that you were," he said this is quoting now from December 29th call between Kislyak and Flynn, "since you were interested in the issue of the Middle East and you called me on that issue," that is the previous time, that is about the first resolution at the UN, he says this, "we wanted to convey to you and through you to the president-elect that we have significant reservations about the idea of adopting now the principles for the Middle East that our American colleagues are pushing for." Wow. They were pushing for this. The Obama administration was pushing another resolution. And then further down in the call, Kislyak said this, "I would say that our reservations about this new resolution are more about the way it's being developing instead of bringing everybody on board," meaning the United States was acting alone on this, and they were trying to push it through the UN and trying to get everyone else on board quickly so that it would pass. And the Russians decided that was just horrible planning and horrible timing, and we're not going to let the Americans do this to Israel, wow, which, again, Israel and America are meant to be best allies.
Well, this is definitely a story I'm sure we will be hearing more about. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has been really focusing on, and he will be focusing, I think, in our next Trumpet edition and a future book that he is working on really exposing the true depth of just what was happening in the Obama administration. A lot of this information coming out very recently, more and more detail exposing what was happening in the Obama administration. Brent, keep us apprised of those details as you encounter them. I know you've been digging into that pretty deeply, and we look forward to reading more about that. One final story, violence unfolded for several nights in a city in France. To learn why, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so we're talking about Dijon, but this is something much more serious, about something much more serious than mustard. You had basically the police just losing control over the weekend in an important city in France. On Friday, a Chechen teenager was killed and gangs from North Africa, from Algeria, were blamed for this. And so you just had this massive gang clash just take over parts of this city. And the police, like I said, just completely lost control. You had reports of Chechens coming from all over France and even Belgium and other neighboring countries to kind of then carry out reprisal attacks on North Africa, on these North Africans. You basically had two different Muslim gangs, Chechen Muslims from Russia and North African Muslims fighting each other. You had pictures of people gearing up with things like assault rifles. There was a crowd of 100 armed with knives and baseball bats. They attacked a North African bar on Friday night. The Daily Sabah wrote, scenes of unrest, including men brandishing what appear to be assault rifles as well as handguns and clubs, shocked the country and prompted questions about whether security forces had taken sufficient measures to stop the fighting. So you had a lot of French people just looking on at what was really a pretty scary situation. Seeing that for several days then, now they did come down at the start of this week, Monday, Tuesday, in force, and retook the streets there. But you saw a pretty scary situation for a while there. So one of the key trends that we've been watching in Europe is this kind of so-called clash of civilizations, that Europe would become more Christian. And at the same time, you have this clash building with radical Islam led by Iran in the Middle East. And you see events like what's happening in Dijon really tie into that, where a lot of people are getting more and more concerned about the Muslim presence in their midst. They're seeing it. I mean, the Dijon riots, they're just the latest in a series of clashes. We talked about some of the armed clashes in Paris. And so I think you're seeing it push Europe into the direction of having a more Christian identity because they're emphasizing their differences with these immigrants. And it's pushing France and many of these countries to take a more hardline position on Islam. And it's something that's leading to a clash that's prophesied in the Bible in Daniel chapter 11. And we have an article, Clash of Civilizations, Real or Racist, that talks about this growing clash in Europe and how that ties into it is an important part of Bible prophecy.
All right. Thank you for that, Richard. We'll link to that in the show notes. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Herbert Spencer. The ultimate result of shielding men from the effects of folly is to fill the world with fools. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.